Jeff Levering and wife Ashley love their new patio door from Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin.
It's like having a brand new kitchen.
I love the roll screen. The fact that the screen is on the inside.
Get 0% interest for up to 48 months. Visit PellaWI.com.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Come join the conversation on the Old National Bank talk and text line at 855-616-1620. Old National Bank. Get old. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome to the show. So, Eric Bilstadt, a story from the world of sports that I think is one of these incredibly undercovered stories. The team with the best record in baseball is the Tampa Bay Rays, right, who won 2 out of 3 from the Brewers, you know, last week. They're having a magical season. They're 35-14. They're 22-4 at home. 22-4. Can you imagine that? Right. So last night, you have, they played at home against the Toronto Blue Jays. Would you like to guess how many people showed up at the game? Now, I correct that. How many tickets were sold for the game, not how many people sold. Yeah, because that's it. It's tickets reported. So not how many people were there. Would you like to guess how many people were there? Best record in baseball, 22-4 at home. Would you like to guess?
2,800.
Well, no, that's Oakland. Oakland.
Okay, it's not that bad.
Oakland. Oakland is averaging like 3,000 people a game because, you know, this is like they're on their way out. 8,000. Let me be precise here. 8,800 people. They drew 8,800 people for the best team in baseball and who's just doing nothing but win at home. Now, I understand it was a Monday night, but still, 8,800 people.
That's so disappointing. The stadium is kind of goofy, too, but I don't know if that matters.
Well, no, but, I mean, you just wonder. I mean, it's why some people... You know, it's why some people can't have nice things because you just want, I mean, their attendance has been awful. Mm-hmm. I mean, and if you say, okay, Jeff, it's a Monday night, be fair. They're averaging like 17,000 fans, you know, and that includes like Friday and Saturday and Sundays. I mean, they're not drawing flies for a team like this. And you just kind of wonder how long teams can survive when you're not drawing people like that.
Not long. It wouldn't shock me if they move someday.
Absolutely. Now, in comparison, the Brewers, who are doing okay, they got crushed last night, you know, but their Monday night attendance, again, this is tickets sold, so it's not necessarily bodies to the turnstile, but they drew 22,500 last night, which, I mean, Houston's a really good team, but it's a Monday night, you know, so I mean, I think that is respectable. They'd like it to be more, but it's sure a lot better than 8,800.
Oh,
8,800 fans, yeah, to watch the team with the best record in baseball. Go figure. Okay, we got a lot of ground to cover on today's program. Let's start off with my stupid criminal story of the day. Now, I've often said this from my perspective as a former prosecutor. Sometimes cases are hard. Sometimes it's difficult to prove cases. And other times it's kind of like low-hanging fruit. This would be the low-hanging fruit. All right. Wauwatosa police released video yesterday of two chases that happened on March 15th. Well, actually, it wasn't really two chases. It was kind of like one chase interrupted by a car switch. Police said the first chase started around 8 p.m. on Burleigh near the Menominee River Parkway, where officers tried stopping a Hyundai that they believed may have been stolen. Guy driving the Hyundai takes off, right? Driver fails to stop, starts the chase. The chase ends near Hampton and Appleton when the Hyundai becomes disabled. Video shows the tires sparking, all sorts of things. So the car gets disabled. What happens next? According to police, the driver is picked up by a known female associate, and they take off in the lady's car. So apparently, somewhere in the chase, the first chase, the guy behind the wheel calls his girlfriend or whatever and says, here, I'm in the middle of this police chase. You got to come bail me out. So she pulls up her car. He gets out. He jumps into the second car, and then the chase continues. Okay, so where do the guy and the gal go? Apparently, the chase comes to an end when the man and women run into, wait for it, the man's home near 89th and Stark. So they lead police on a high-speed chase and drive to his house, where they then run inside. At this point in time, they are ultimately arrested. Police said there was a gun and there were drugs inside the house. Stupid criminal story of today. If I was to give any free legal advice to people who decide stupidly to lead the police on a high-speed chase, my advice would be don't drive to your own home. Or do drive to your own home. Make it really, really easy for the police. Let us get started. There is a tendency nowadays, I think in many places, for us as consumers to be nickel and dimed. If you're a regular listener to this program, one of the things that always drives me crazy is when you go to a nicer restaurant, and the big thing nowadays is everything is a la carte. You know, they want to charge you $52 for the steak. But then if you want a baked potato with that or a salad with that or some asparagus with your steak, well, the baked potato is $10 and the asparagus is $8. You know, I mean, they charge you for everything and it drives me crazy. I mean, it's one of the things is just tell me what it's going to cost, but just give me a meal. Okay. When I go to a restaurant, I expect to get a starch. I expect to get, you know, a vegetable. I expect to get whatever my entree is. Just give me this price. But that's not how they do it. And really, do you really need to charge me $10 for a baked potato that probably costs you, you know, maybe a dime? So it's just, I hate this nickel and diming thing. And that's why I always like going to the restaurants where, okay, this is it. You know, your meal is going to be $30 or whatever, but you're going to get the piece of fish. You're going to get the starch. You're going to, you know, get soup or salad or whatever it is. I hate being nickeled and dimed like that. And that is precisely what has been going on with many, many airlines nowadays. You know, if you've flown some of these discount airlines, what they do is they have like these teaser fees that are in there. Okay, this is how much we're going to charge you to fly from Milwaukee to Fort Myers or Milwaukee to Orlando or whatever. And you go, oh, that's really cool. But then you start to read the small print. Well, if you want to check a bag, it's going to cost you X amount of dollars. If you want to take a carry-on bag, it's going to cost you X amount of dollars. And let me see a show of hands. I don't think there's too many people that are able to fly nowadays, even if you have like a second home that you're traveling to, that you're able to fly without any sort of luggage at all, whether it's a personal item or whether it's checking some bags. And then if you want a seat, you want to have a seat assigned, well, that's going to cost you extra. It's the nickel and diming of things. And pretty soon you find out, gee, because I had to check a bag and I wanted to bring a carry-on bag with me and I wanted to know where I was going to sit, so I had to pay extra for that. On these quote-unquote discount airlines, you then find out that you're pretty much paying almost as much as if you would have gone to what I will call the full-service airlines. But here is the latest thing that airlines are doing just in time for summer travel. They are starting to charge people if you want a physical boarding pass. Now, for many, many, many of us, when we travel, you know, if you have the airlines app on your phone, what you can do is you can check in via the phone or you can and then you can download your boarding pass. So you have it on your phone. Most airlines, I think all airlines, still offer you the option of having a hard copy of your boarding pass. Now, typically, because this is who I am, I always have a backup. I download it. It's on my phone. But when I check in, I almost always, and I typically, like, I fly Southwest a lot. So at Southwest, you can check in 24 hours before your flight. So when I check in for my flight, I have the boarding pass downloaded on my phone, but I also print on my personal computer, I print a hard copy of the boarding pass. So I have the hard copy of the boarding pass with me. I always think, well, it's just a convenience. Similarly, if you go to the airport, most airlines have those kiosks that are there. And I'll give you an example, Southwest, because again, I fly Southwest pretty much almost all the time. So you go there and what you do is you put in your confirmation number and you tell them how many bags that you have and they give you the baggage tags and you put them on your bags and then you go up and you give them to them. And at that same time, if you want, you can also print a hard copy of the boarding pass. And I routinely do that. Now, can I download it? Absolutely. But quite frankly, a lot of times it's just a lot easier for me to have that hard copy of the boarding pass as a backup in case something happens to the phone. What could happen? I don't know. Yeah, the battery suddenly, you know, dies on you. You do something and you get locked out temporarily. I mean, I've never thought that there's anything wrong with having that backup of the hard copy of the boarding pass. So you're all set to go. But here's the latest thing. Wall Street Journal. Want a printed airline boarding pass? Be ready to shell out $25. Some airline passengers, Lori Ulster has anxiety about flying. Hers has nothing to do with engine trouble or turbulence. She frets about relying on her phone to display her mobile boarding pass at a boarding gate. For every flight, she prints it out at home or at the airport. I want to have that piece of paper, says Ulster, a 57-year-old writer and copy editor in Pelham, New York. I just tuck it into my passport. There's no worries about preserving the battery on my phone. Fears of fumbling around with a phone at the gate while impatient travelers harumph behind you or getting hobbled by a dying battery or dodgy Wi-Fi get some passengers more anxious about boarding the plane than flying at 35,000 feet. Airlines looking to save time and money and add a new fee or two are putting pressure on passengers to go digital. Alaska Airlines, for one, is overhauling its check-in lobbies and going to the point that if you want to have a physical boarding pass, you will have to pay $25 for the privileges of doing that. 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. Look, I understand that we have to be more self-reliant. I understand that, for example, airlines are looking to cut things. But at some point in time, don't we collectively end up saying enough is enough? And yes, I understand you can put the phone on you can put the thing on your phone. And then, I mean, the last couple of times when I've been sitting in gates, we've been lectured by the gate agent that you have to turn the brightness up all the way or else it's not going to register or things like that. But really, for those of us who, for whatever reasons, and it's not like I'm tech shy with regard to things like that, but $25 to print your own physical boarding pass? All right. At some point in time, don't we say enough is enough? 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. All right. For those of you who like me, who still like to have our physical hard boarding passes, what do you think about having to pay for them? We discuss in just a moment. 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. Yeah, in the latest effort to try to generate revenue, airlines are now starting to charge you for printing off boarding passes. So in other words, if you go to the airport and, you know, you have to have the boarding pass printed off, there's a cost, sometimes up to $25 for this. Now, look, I understand that most people just download it onto their app and then go, but really, are we really at a point where it's reasonable to charge people for printing off paper copies of the boarding passes? 855-616-1620. Let's start with Nick in Waterford. Hi, Nick. You're on WTMJ.
Jeff, nice to talk to you.
Thanks for calling.
I have a business plan, and sometimes the numerous members on my phone plan burn through. They call it unlimited Wi-Fi, but that's not always correct. And my parents are snowbirds down in Florida, and they don't have internet access.
Right.
So I use the Southwest app, but it's always very hard. I can try and check in, but I'm always leery about trying to print off those.
Yeah.
Trying to get the mobile app on, and I was telling the screener, I have also a problem with, like, the Fiserv Forum getting, in Ticketmaster, getting mobile tickets with everything. It's just very nerve-wracking rather than having a paper copy in your hand.
Yeah, well, it is. And look, maybe just like, I don't know, you know, hard copies of newspapers aren't read by anybody under 70 or so. I appreciate it. Maybe there'll be a time when it adapts. But is this really something that you need to charge a fee for? I mean, is the idea of if you go to a self-service kiosk, for example, and you print off that boarding pass, why should you be charged for having the physical copy of
That's what I do. I travel. Yeah. I have a wife, two kids, and all the luggage. We have to print off all our baggage tickets and attach that ourselves and bring it to them.
Right. Right.
So what's the cost to them to just print off a little baggage or a little boarding pass for?
Exactly. No, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Now, I mean, look, I understand that there's sometimes that people get involved. The last time we went to Florida, we took our dog with us. So, and our dog is small enough, she flies under the seat. But you have to pay extra. At Southwest, it's $90, $95 or whatever. And you have to go to, you know, one of the people at the gate, at the check-in thing. And you have to say, okay, well, here's the deal. And I've made reservations for the dog. And then, you know, you have to give them the credit card and all that sort of stuff. And then they give you the magic thing that you put on the dog carrier. So, I mean, I understand. I'm paying extra money for the privilege of taking my dog on the plane. I get it, but it's like, all right, I'm already going to be getting on the plane regardless of, you know, with the boarding pass. Why is it really costing the airline $25, for example, even if I go up to the window and ask the clerk to print off the boarding pass for me? Is it really costing the airline $5, $10, $25? Or is this just another way of, again, my phrase is nickel and diming people? Sandy and Eagle. Sandy, you're on WTMJ. Hello.
Hi, Jeff. I was just calling your screener. You know, I want a hard copy. I'm 71. I'm elderly. I have to fetch my reading glasses. I'm not tech savvy. I really worked well in the world that I grew up in and functioned in for the main things in my life, and then everything changed.
Yeah.
And I'll do what I have to do to get by, but I don't want everything in my life to start going this way. And what about moms? They're carrying a baby. They have a baby bottle. You know, they have a diaper bag, and they're supposed to go fishing around for their phone and get the thing in their phone. The other thing is the main thing that I have a lot to say about this, but it makes me not have a pleasurable trip.
Well,
because of the service.
Yeah, well, thanks for calling. See, and I guess it's just, it's like so many different things. And I want to bring the end of this conversation, I'll bring it back to where we started. It's this idea that, can you adapt? Absolutely. And look, and I understand things are changing. A number of our texters are making the points about, well, Jeff, you know, how do you go to baseball games? And it used to be, like, I'm a season ticket holder. We got a 20-game pack. And it used to be, and it was kind of cool, every spring, I'd get a mailing from the Brewers, and it would have the hard copies of our tickets to the games, you know, and you know, they don't do that anymore. I guess you can pay extra, I think. So now I have the ballpark app, and the tickets are just there, and it's all digital. And yes, you can adapt, and no, I don't want to pay extra for the hard copies. And yes, it makes it easier if it's all digital to transfer the tickets. So, you know, if you can't go one night and you want to give them to a friend and they've got the ballpark app, you can just forward them. So in many respects, it makes it easier. I appreciate that. I am not a Luddite when it comes to, you know, technology and things like that. But at the same time, there are the idea of being, for example, just charged because I want to have a backup physical boarding pass in my pocket because, again, I'm afraid that maybe something's going to go wrong with the phone or whatever. I just like that comfort of having that redundancy. That's the phrase, right? The redundancy. So I've got it on my phone. I've got it on the hard copy of it. I'm all set. Boom. Should I really have to pay for it? Just tell me how much the overall experience is going to be. Give me one charge and then let me get on the plane and don't make me pay for this little stuff. That's where I feel. But I acknowledge that I am standing in front of a runaway train because that's not the way business is going. I'm getting texts from people saying, well, you know, you can take a screenshot of your thing. Yeah, look, I get it. I understand, you know, you go in, you check in over the internet, you tell them, send your boarding pass to your phone, then you transfer it to your wallet. I know how to do it. I get it. I understand how to do it. I'm just saying that I like that redundancy of also printing the boarding pass. And for airlines to charge those of us who like to have the hard copy printed $3, $5, $10, $25, I think is ridiculous. That's just me. That Stephanie Rapkin story is one of the most interesting stories of the day. You know, for people who haven't been following it, she's the 60-some-year-old Shorewood lawyer who, during the racial justice protests in 2020, she's on Oakland Avenue, right by that Metro Mart that's there, and finds herself in the middle of one of these protests. And, you know, her story is she becomes intimidated because she's kind of surrounded by the protesters and stuff. But it's undisputed that she spits on one of the protesters. And she said that she spit on the ground. Well, she spit on the guy. So she goes to trial on this. Instead of settling it, she goes to trial. She is convicted. And then today she shows up for sentencing. And the judge, Laura Crivello, does one of these deals where, okay, I'm going to sentence you to 60 days in, they don't call it the House of Correction anymore. They call it the Community Reintegration Center or something like that. But yeah, it's the House of Correction, right? Okay, that's it. So they sentence her to 60 days in the House of Correction. And then the judge, they always pause after they sentence this. But I'm going to stay that sentence in favor of putting you on probation for a year and doing 100 hours of community service. And she says, no.
Didn't want to do the community service, I guess, or the probation.
Yeah, she says, well, apparently the judge says this is an avenue for somebody to go from being a productive citizen to a social pariah to reintegrate with the community. And the defendant says, she says, nah, nobody's going to accept me, and it's just not viable. I'd rather go to jail right now and take care of it. Just don't. I don't want the probation. I don't want the community service. You know, I just, here, send me to jail for 60 days.
Did not see that one coming this morning.
Oh,
I was not expecting her to take the jail time.
Oh, yeah,
saw it.
Well, I guess I mean, I don't. I'm not surprised about that. I'm just, you know, now once she gets to the House of Correction or whatever we call it now, you know, after a couple nights, you know, in the Community Reintegration Center, she might rethink her position. But or maybe not. Maybe she's 67 years old, so she's going to be spending 60 days as a guest of Milwaukee County as a response. You know, it's just, but I mean, I get it. She's like, no, I just want to get this over with here. I'm going, I think clearly Ms. Rapkin marches to her own drummer. I think that would be a fair thing to say.
It.
Yeah, she marches to her own drummer and has throughout this entire case. But that's the wrap up to this case. They put her on probation. And she said, no, not interested. No, just take me away. Okay, we all make interesting choices. When we come back, have you driven around this city any time lately? We'll discuss it. So very glad to have you with us. By the way, as we've been doing for a couple weeks now, I always like to mention it, we broadcast the show now as well. You can, in addition to listening to us live or listening to us wherever you get your podcasts from, you can also watch us if you choose to do that. And a number of people do. The easiest way to do it is simply to go to WTMJ.com, click the button that says Watch Live, and got all these cameras in the studio, and you can watch us as we do spoken word radio. You can also subscribe to the YouTube channel. WTMJ has its own YouTube channel. Who knew? And you can go there and you can watch the various programs. And again, a number of people do that. And it's always kind of fun to keep track of the people that are watching. Okay, so if you have tried to drive anywhere around this area, now I'm not talking about dealing with like the reckless driving and the shootings and things like that. I'm just talking about trying to drive anywhere. It is almost impossible to get from wherever you're going to wherever you started from without running into major sorts of construction. Now, I understand what's going on. Part of it is that it's spring, it's summer, we've got a shortened road construction season, so you try to do stuff. The other thing that happens, though, is some of these road projects are being paid for with COVID money, and there's a time limit on when that money has to be spent. And so you've got some communities that are flush with the taxpayer paid for COVID money, so they've got to do the road improvements. Local newspaper, as a story, how long will I-43 be under construction? And then it talks about what they're doing, Glendale to Grafton. And if you've tried to drive from Glendale to Grafton on I-43, I mean, good luck. You've got ramps that are taken out and disappeared. You've got, the traffic is constantly being restructured. You've got freeways, the freeway, which is regularly closed a couple nights a week after 9 or 9:30. if you ever are unfortunate enough to run into a circumstance where there is a collision or an accident, it takes three or four times longer to clear because there's no side roads anymore. I mean, you've got like two lanes going through these construction areas each way. And what happens if a car becomes disabled, there's nothing you can do. There's no way for the tow truck to get there in any sort of easy fashion at all. And it's just an ongoing mess. On top of that, a number of the non-freeway streets are under construction as well. Try to go west on Mequon Road if you live in Ozaukee County. You know, good luck with that. Try to go west on Capitol Drive. Good luck with that. And I was thinking about this as I was driving around yesterday, caught again in the ongoing, you know, traffic jams that are there, trying to think of alternative routes to try to get to where I had to go. And I'm like, no, I can't do that because if I get off here, I'm going to run into this road construction. And if I get off here, I'm going to run into that road construction. And you kind of become resigned to the fact that, you know, anywhere you're going to have to go is going to take X amount of time longer to get around because we are doing this all at once. And as I was thinking about that, I was looking around at the number of the other vehicles that were stuck with me in traffic. And I have to say, I'd say about a quarter of them were trucks related to business, whether it was home improvement trucks or trucks from plumbers or delivery services or whatever. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm driving this to and from work or wherever I'm going to try to go on a given time. And I at least have options to do this. I have options of routes, and there's nothing that says that I have to go to a particular location except to come to work and go back from work. But these, whether it's the service industry or whether it's the people, the delivery drivers who have no choice. I mean, you get the call. You're the plumber. You're the HVAC guy. You get the call that, you know, the air conditioner is out at a certain location, or, you know, there's a leak or the hot water heater is disrupted at so-and-so's house. You don't have any choice. You are just stuck in this. And I guess I kept thinking, as bad as it is for those of us who, you know, just are driving our cars to try to get to places. And sometimes it's just, like I say, it's situations where, okay, I've got stuff to take to the dry cleaners, but I don't have to take it right now. All right. And if I know the traffic is really bad, I can just delay that. But if this is your business and you are out and about on the roadways, you have no choice. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. How bad are the roads due to all the construction? Because, like I say, my experience is I come to work, I return from work. Every once in a while, we'll go to a baseball game or we'll have dinner and things like that. But there's always some flexibility. You can make changes and things like that. If you're driving for a business, there's no flexibility. You have to get to a particular location. And all I can imagine is this has got to be screwing up schedules for service people all over the region. 855-616-1620. That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. How bad are you finding this as you try to get around to either do your job or to get to your jobs? We discuss in just a moment. And don't get me wrong, I understand that you have to have the road work. I'm just saying that it's all going on at once. And trying to get around in this region is becoming next to impossible. Jeff, you should come to Kenosha. It's horrendous. I drive on average 100 miles a day, taking people to doctor's appointments. It's not fun. There's no, you know, question about that. Jeff, I live in Greenfield, but frequent the West Allis area, and the whole road on Oklahoma out to New Berlin is a mess. Roads having us driving on opposite side of the road, dug up all over eastbound. I work in New Berlin, so I see it daily. Last week, down Wisconsin Avenue after leaving the Lizzo concert to catch the bus home was awful. Also, it is literally one lane to drive downtown. Yeah, I mean, see, that's it. It's just all going on at once. Part of it is COVID money, but it's making it almost impossible to get around. And as bad as it is for those of us who, you know, have to commute to work and things like that, I can only imagine what it's like for the people who have to drive for a living. and how you handle that. Okay, my hot water heater is leaking. Okay, no problem, sir. No problem, ma'am. You know, we'll have the vehicle out there. We'll have somebody out there to look at it. They'll be there between, you know, 3 and 3:30. And they get caught up in the traffic trying to get from one end of the town to another. Now they're there at 4:30 and everybody's hacked off at them. Jeff in Milwaukee. Jeff, you're on WTMJ. Hello.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I'm a truck driver and currently working on that I-43 project, and I worked on it quite a few hours last year, way up on the north end in Grafton there. And you talk about, you know, you people try to get around town and so on and so forth. Well, when you got 30, 40 trucks coming in at a time, mm-hmm. you know, from point A to take your product to point B in the middle of that median, and they're crossing all over the lanes of traffic to get to here to there, it's not a fun day out there.
No, nothing's fun. So where are you working now? What part of the 43 project are you working on now?
North of Highland.
Okay, so on some of the more northern parts of it. Yeah, and look, and I mean, I see that the work is being done. Hey, thanks for calling, Jeff. This is not a criticism of the workers and the people who are doing this. My criticism is that it's all being done at once. And you do wonder whether or not there needed to be or there should have been some coordination if you're going to undertake some of these massive freeway projects, which then, you know, cause people to look for alternative routes. So then the alternative routes are all torn up as well. And you get to a point where it really becomes, I don't want to say impossible, but extremely difficult to get around. And it's not like some of these projects are going to go away anytime soon. The North-South I-43 project, that's going to be another 2 years, at least another 2 years of this. You know, Jeff, I live in Germantown. Currently, there are three bridges that are under repairs. It's amazing to get around. I have to use Google Maps to go from one location to another location. That's only 3 miles away. It's ridiculous. Jeff, what about police and firefighter response times? Well, that's a very good point, but it's one of the reasons why if there is a collision, use whatever word you want, because if there is a collision, there's just no way for the fire trucks, there's no way for the rescue trucks, there's no way for the cops in many cases to get to the disabled vehicles, short of, again, doing incredible closures so they can get there and they can tow the vehicles away. Just tough. Jeff, they just closed down South 70th Street, just south of I-94, for a total bridge replacement. Couple that with the 84th Street off-ramp closed near State Fair Park and road construction on National Avenue through West Allis, and you have a recipe for major frustration. I work for a large crane rental and specialized trucking company, and this will surely create many delays and headaches for our dispatchers, drivers, and crane operators. Knowing this in advance, I made sure to request a week of PTO during the state fair in August. Oh, yeah. I mean, it needs to be done. I mean, there's no question. It needs to be done. But the idea that we're going to do it all at once is what the problem is. Jeff, I've been waiting over a year to get one bridge finished in Grant Park. Well, and look, I don't claim to be a construction expert, so I don't know why some of this stuff takes as long as it takes. But we would think that you would parcel this out and figure out, okay, let's find what the alternative route is going to be. And if it means that we've got to do this on the freeway, then maybe we shouldn't be tearing up Port Washington Road. Just saying. But if you think it's bad for those of you who are driving in cars, just feel bad for the people who are doing the delivery work or the service people, the folks that are doing it every day, all day. It's just a killer. It's a version of one of the Wagner's rules of life, but it's really simple. If you fire a gun at police officers, bad things are going to happen. Sunday night, 10 o'clock, 10:10, Mount Pleasant police sent to an address after a report of a domestic incident with shots fired. Right. The guy they're looking for leaves the address before the cops get there. He was known to them. He has a lengthy criminal record. Apparently, they find the guy a couple hours later in Racine. Instead of stopping and surrendering, the man gets out of the car, runs to a wooded area, hides in tall grass. About 12:30 a.m., officers find out where he is. They tell the guy to come out. He refuses commands. As the officers approach him, he begins firing shots in the direction of the officers. Huh. He's shooting at the cops. The cops then fire back. They hit him, and he's pronounced dead at the scene. It's an unfortunate situation. I was watching television this morning, and the guy's sister was on the TV saying, "Oh, I can't believe the police shot my brother." And, of course, they should have used dogs or something. Well, okay, at some point in time, when you have somebody who hasn't been out of prison for that long, who's involved in a shots-fired incident, who flees from the cops, who refuses commands, and then shoots at the police, bad things are going to happen. And it's not the fault of the police. Pure and simple, no matter how some people would like to play it.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the program. So very, very glad to have you with us. All right, the theme of this hour of the program is, who's really the extremist? Now, you have to understand, and we discussed this a little bit yesterday, you have to understand what is going on in the national media. The national media, the mainstream media, wants to see Donald Trump become the Republican nominee for president. Well, why? They hate Trump. Yes, yes, yes. The New York Times and CBS and NBC and MSNBC and ABC, yes, they hate Donald Trump. They do. But they also recognize the reality, as do many Democrats, that Donald Trump is probably the one Republican in the country running against Joe Biden, who Joe Biden beats. And I understand that there's some of you who just are part of the cult of Donald Trump, and I don't mean that in an offensive way, who just refuse to see it. But that is just the reality. And that's why you see, and it's a strategy that Democrats have been employing for the last couple election cycles, where they try to identify the Republican candidate in a primary that they believe is the weakest, and then they push that candidate, and then that candidate wins the primaries and then goes on to lose the general election. I believe you saw that happen in Wisconsin in the governor's race as well. But that's kind of the strategy. So now that there are other candidates who are emerging to run against Donald Trump in the Republican primaries, you now have this concerted effort that's out there to try to destroy those candidates. So Trump wins, and then at least wins the primary, and then goes on to lose the general election. And that's just the reality of what is going on. I'm a huge fan of Tim Scott. You know, we talked about this yesterday, and I don't know if he has the legs to become the Republican nominee, but I will tell you, I think the Republican Party could go a lot farther and do a lot worse than Tim Scott. And I think once he becomes a more viable candidate, you're going to see more of the relentless negative coverage of Tim Scott. Right now, that relentless negative coverage is being directed at Ron DeSantis, the very, very successful governor of Florida, who is scheduled to announce sometime this week that he is running for president. And I think if you look at a lot of the polls, what you see is that DeSantis, you know, beats Joe Biden. At least that's how the polls shape up. Plus, DeSantis is not a drag on down ballot races like Trump is. So for the last several months, there has been this effort in the mainstream media to kind of demonize Ron DeSantis. And look, I'm not arguing that the guy is perfect, but some of the stuff that's been raised against him is just, frankly, it's just embarrassing. You know, it started several months ago when you had the whole controversy over what the media has conveniently labeled the Don't Say Gay legislation in Florida. Oh, this idea that, you know, you're not allowed to, you know, say the word gay in Florida schools. Well, no, what it actually did is it said that when you are teaching in schools in Florida, the curriculum has to be age appropriate. And it said, yes, for first and second and third graders, we're not going to teach human sexuality. It wasn't that you can't say gay. The argument was, hey, you know, why, when you're dealing with a second grader, why are we talking about the birds and the bees, or the birds and the birds and the bees and the bees, or whatever that might be? It's just, it's inappropriate for that age group. But, of course, this gets spun as the don't say gay sort of thing, demonstrating that, oh, he's hostile towards, you know, the rights of, you know, gay people or that sort of community. It was never that. And I think, you know, most people would argue, if you would say to most people, gee, do you think you should really be talking about human sexuality to, you know, first and second and third graders, as opposed to simply teaching them how to read and write and do basic math? I think most people would say, well, no, why would we be talking about human sexuality to those young sort of children? Well, so now it's starting to play out again this week. The week that DeSantis is supposed to announce he's going to run for president, you have the NAACP jumping in. And we talked a little bit about this yesterday. The NAACP, whose president, by the way, lives in Tampa, Florida, issuing what they call a travel advisory for Florida, warning people of color to be aware of the open hostility towards African Americans and people of color. All right. So this is, of course, it's an effort to try to undermine DeSantis as he gets ready to run for office. The NAACP says this was in response to the policies of Governor DeSantis, specifically. Now, I'm quoting here. The aggressive attempts to erase black history and to restrict diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in Florida schools. All right, we're not going to teach black history. Matter of fact, somebody said to me this morning, well, you know, how could anybody support Ron DeSantis if he doesn't think that they should teach black history? To which my response was, there's nothing, that's just a flat out fabrication. Wall Street Journal has a great editorial about this. Florida public schools are required by law to teach students about the enslavement experience, abolition, the civil rights movement, and the history and contributions of Americans, of African Americans. That's what the law says. Students, this is part of the statewide curriculum, students develop an understanding of the ramifications of prejudice, racism, and stereotyping on individual freedoms. All right, so that's what is part of the curriculum. Here's apparently the issue. Recently, Florida rejected the College Board's new AP class in African American Studies, full of non-historical topics like black queer studies and the case for reparations. These politicized topics were watered down, but they said, hey, look, you know, if you want to bring them back, we will take a look at this. You know, when the NAACP says that Florida schools don't teach African American history, that's candidly just not accurate. And it's really kind of disappointing that this stuff is going on. It's not surprising, but you have, again, it's this conscious effort to try to weaken Ron DeSantis, and it's being done with the idea of, if we weaken Ron DeSantis, maybe what we can do, that means that Donald Trump wins by default, and then we know that Trump can't win in November. Look, I'm not saying that Ron DeSantis is the be-all, end-all. I think he's a very, very strong candidate, and I think he's going to have a lot of appeal to conservatives. And one of the things people need to know is, you know, you, in some respects, judge the quality of DeSantis by the attacks he's getting. I'm not saying DeSantis is perfect. The picking the fight with Disney, to me, that's just kind of a waste of spirit. But these attacks about schools and, oh, the NAACP is issuing a travel advisory and things like that, it's pure politics, nothing more, nothing less. And I think the more people find out about it, actually, the more the backlash is going to help benefit DeSantis. When we come back, as long as we're talking about extremism, who's extreme on abortion? Stick around. So very glad to have you with us. I know over the last well, actually over a number of years, but particularly the last year, that I have irritated some of you with my position on the whole pro-life, pro-choice movement. And let me just restate that again to launch into where we're going. I respect people's positions on both sides of the issue. Abortion is a very, very complex and very, very personal decision. And how you feel about it depends on a number of things. It depends on your personal circumstances. It depends on your religious views and a number of other factors, life experience, whatever. The reality is the majority of people believe that at least some form of abortion should be allowed. I think the vast majority of people believe in cases of rape or incest, women should be allowed to get abortions. The vast majority, or at least a significant majority of people, also believe that elective abortions up to a certain point should be permitted. Now, I understand there's some people who don't understand, Jeff, it's murder, etc. But the vast majority, or at least a majority of Americans, don't agree with that position. And they're balancing out the rights of the pregnant woman versus the rights of the unborn child. And people come up with a different balancing test. Here is the reality. And ever since the Dobbs case that outlawed, that struck down Roe versus Wade, Republicans have been losing elections. Why? It's because, again, Democrats are running on the abortion issue. And they're saying, look, here's the deal. The Republicans don't want to allow any form of abortion at all, or very, very few forms of abortion. And what you're seeing is you're seeing huge voter turnout. People are responding. It is motivating people to go to the polls. And that is why in races, even races that have nothing to do with abortion at all, you have candidates running on the abortion issue. Which means if Republicans are going to start to win elections statewide in Wisconsin and candidly, you know, to capture the presidency and with the swing states you need, there needs to be movement on the abortion issue. That's just, I believe that's the reality. You are starting to see some of that movement. A number of, and look, my position all along, and again, I understand it antagonizes some of you and you disagree with me, but that's fine. I'm here to tell you what I think has to happen. That is, I think Republicans need to develop a position that is what I would describe mainstream on this. I believe the mainstream position, like I say, is that the majority of people believe that in cases of, incest or rape, women should be able to have abortions. I believe that the mainstream position is that elective abortion should be permitted up to a certain point. Now, this is where, you know, reasonable people, I guess, disagree with this. More and more legislatures have been adopting a 12-week ban, a 12-week status, namely that, you know, before 12 weeks, elective abortions are permitted. After 12 weeks, there needs to be elective abortions are not permitted, but abortions are allowed in cases like the life of the mother and things like that. But the standard that's being set is 12 weeks. Now, I don't know, for example, if 12 weeks is exactly the right time period. If you look at 14 weeks, I think the numbers say that 92% of all abortions are performed within that 14 weeks. And if you go out to 16 weeks, I think it's, 16 or 17, 96 or 97% of abortions are performed at that point in time. So beyond that limit, whether it's 12 weeks or 14 weeks or 16 weeks, beyond that, you are talking about just a small number of abortions that are performed. Now, the Wall Street Journal has a really interesting piece that caught my attention. Who's extreme on abortion? Republicans need to make the point that Democrats favor no restrictions whatever. And that is true. Many, many Democrats do not believe that there should be any limitations at all on abortion. So in the effort to try to determine who the real extremist is, my point has been if the Republican Party can unite around what I would call reasonable reasonable limitations, recognizing that even for people who believe that, you know, in their personal life, they would never have an abortion, never encourage their children to have abortions, never encourage their grandchildren to have abortions, but recognizing that the majority of Americans believe that there should be some opportunity for elective abortions. My question is, if the Republican Party were to come out and say 12 weeks, which they're doing in some states, 14 weeks, 16 weeks, whatever that number is, and you can tie it into fetal heartbeat, you can tie it into all sorts of different things, does that get the Republican Party past the issue of abortion? And do you flip the script and then campaign and say, look, well, we're in favor of reasonable limitations on this? You know, we believe that there should be people who have, again, elective abortions, but beyond a certain point, whatever that point is, 12 weeks, 14 weeks, 16 weeks, beyond that, absent cases of life of the mother, that's the extreme position, arguing that you should be able to have elective abortions at any point in time you want. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. Would you like to hear some Republican politicians articulate a position on that? And does that potentially take the abortion issue off the table? Because as long as the no abortion position appears to be the Republican Party position, I think they're going to continue to lose elections. 855-616-1620. We discuss. 855-616-1620. That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. I think that there needs over the next year or so to be a lot of soul searching in the Republican Party. And I understand that the Republican Party, in my opinion, is much more diverse when it comes to positions on abortion than the Democrat Party is. There are people who are pro-life. There are people who are pro-choice, and both views are tolerated in the Republican Party. Democrats, you know, try being a pro-life Democrat. You know, good luck with that. But within that, we need to recognize, I think, where the majority of Americans are, which is that elective abortions at a certain point should be permitted if people make that decision. Now, the question becomes, at what point? Is it 12 weeks? Is it 14 weeks? Is it 16 weeks? You pick 16 weeks, and you've pretty much covered almost all abortions there are. I think that, you know, candidly, if you want to see Republicans take this issue and turn it around, you do a 14-week or a 16-week, you know, limitation, and then the position becomes, look, you know, you've got the other side that's talking about the extremist stuff, elective abortions, you know, beyond where I think most people acknowledge that, you know, you're really dealing with a baby. Jeff, you're very correct what you're saying right now. I'm a Republican. I'm not voting for any Republican until they change their stance. They're going to lose the generation that I'm in. I'm 48 years old, and it's pretty much going to be the nail in the Republican coffin if they don't moderate on the subject of abortions. You know, absolutely. Jeff, the problem Republicans have is for 50 years they have supported no abortions. Now that Roe is flipped, the reality of the position is not popular with the masses, and they are stuck. Well, I don't know if it's not popular with the masses. It's not stuck. It's not popular, admittedly, with a segment of Republican voters who believe, and I appreciate this view, who believe that that abortion is, in fact, murder. The bottom line is, though, that is not where the majority of Americans are. And the electoral reality is, until there is some sort of reasonable accommodation made, you know, all you're going to see in every election is, you know, abortion ads, abortion ads, abortion ads. And for conservatives, that is not a winning issue. And again, as I frequently say, politics is the art of the possible, and people need to wake up for that with that. So Sunday afternoon, I went to my wife's grandson's confirmation, and it was, he was being confirmed in the Catholic Church, and it was a long service. I mean, it started at 2 o'clock, didn't end until after four. But one of the reasons why it was a long service was the fact that there were, by my count, over 100 kids who were going through the confirmation process. Now, they weren't all from that particular Catholic church. They were from other churches as well in the area, but everybody was confirmed at once. And I want to say, in all honesty, it was, and I am not Catholic, and I was not raised Catholic, but I know a lot of people who are, and have been to a lot of Catholic services, and it was a very, I want to say, a moving sort of experience to sit there, because you saw all these young people who were there with their confirmation sponsors, and they had all written things, and the bishop read some of the things that the kids had written. And then, you know, there was a point where each young person, each young man, each young woman, you know, would go up with their sponsor, and the bishop talked to them and things like that. And on the one hand, it's kind of dragging on. But on the other hand, I'm thinking, okay, this is kind of a cool thing. And what was really cool, one of the remarks that the bishop made was that it was so, I guess, rewarding in a time where mainstream religion is perhaps viewed by some people as being out of fashion or passé, that it was refreshing to see this many young people who were making that religious commitment. And I thought, yeah, I thought he nailed it with regard to that. So I was thinking about that when I stumbled across this story. And I mentioned this briefly last week before this confirmation hearing. The Los Angeles Dodgers baseball team, this is not a sports story, but the Los Angeles Dodgers baseball team, like many baseball teams, do community outreach. They're also in the business of selling tickets. So one of the things that they do is they will have nights that are devoted towards, you know, certain interest groups or causes or whatever, with the idea that they will then go out and say, and the Brewers do this too. It's like, for example, in one night in June, they have Pride Night. And what they do is they market specifically to the gay community, and they have, you know, and so they reach out and they try to sell tickets and things like that, and they do some recognition. And that's all well, it's all well and good. It's what they end up doing. And again, it's a way of doing community outreach, and it's a way of reaching out to a certain segment of the community that they hope are going to be fans, etc. No problem with that at all. Now, the Dodgers, though, have created a lot of controversy because next month, June 16th, it's their Pride Night at Dodger Stadium. One of the things that they had decided to do originally as part of their Pride Night is they wanted to give special recognition and an award to a group called the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. It's Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. Now, the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, and I'm looking at some pictures of this. What it is, it's a group of people, and they've been around for a number of years. They dress up, it's men and women who dress up as nuns or priests. And there's like, I'm looking, there's like white makeup, the guys are wearing like eyeshadow and things like that. And what they do is, well, they have a long history of lampooning church traditions. So, I mean, this is a group which admittedly does outreach into the LGBT community, but, you know, part of what they do is, I mean, they're dressed up in drag as nuns and as priests, and they have an element of mocking, you know, members of the Catholic Church. So this is the group, and again, I'm looking at some of the pictures of this stuff. This is the group that the Dodgers decide that they are going to recognize, you know, as part of their community outreach thing. All right, it's this group that essentially does good work, but also their shtick is to, again, mock the Catholic Church. So once this happens, once they announce that they're going to recognize this group, what happens is there's a huge backlash, and a number of people are saying, you know, what are you doing here? I mean, this is a group that's promoting anti-Catholic hate and bigotry and things of the like. And so what the Dodgers do in response to that backlash is they say, okay, we're not going to recognize this group. All right. So once they pull that back, then the other side goes nuts. Then, you know, you have all this. How can you do this? You know, you need to apologize. You know, don't you realize that this is an insult to the gay community? And you've got this group that's done all these things. And yes, they dress up like nuns. And yes, they dress up like priests. And yes, they do this stuff, which, again, you know, lampoons church traditions and things like that. But they're also a vital part of the LGBT community. So how dare you? And all these other groups then threaten that they're going to pull out. At which point now the response is the Dodgers have now apologized again. They have reversed course and they have said, well, we're sorry. And the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence have now been re-invited to receive this award for service to the community. All right. So now, of course, the first groups, the people that were upset that this group that promotes what is described by some as anti-Catholic bigotry and mocking the church, well, now they're upset again. So this, as far as creating controversies, this is kind of like the whole Bud Light thing, you know, and it's you almost want to say to the Dodgers, you know, what were you thinking? And it's not like anybody would suggest that, okay, maybe you shouldn't have a Pride Night, of course. And you would just think, though, in the universe of groups that you had out there that work with the LGBTQ community, you would think that you would be able to find another worthwhile group that wasn't quite as controversial. And I guess that would be my point here. The other point, though, is there are some groups which you can't do anything about. You know, you can't, if there was a comedian and there was a group that was being recognized and there was a perception that they were hostile to the LGBTQ community, you know, there's no way that they would get an award or anything like that. And perhaps that's appropriate. I guess I'm just struck by this notion, though, that there are some things that are okay to mock. And if you've got a group that decides that, again, their whole basis is to dress up like nuns and priests and make fun of the Catholic Church, that there's nothing wrong with that. And that the people who object to that, they're the ones who are bigoted. Our number is 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. I guess I was just thinking about this story at the same time I was watching all these young men and women go through the confirmation process and make their vows and talk about their faith. And I thought, you know, it really is true. In America today, I think the only group that is out there that you can mock and make fun of without any sort of repercussions at all are people of faith. In particular, I would say Christians. That's okay. It's okay to do that. At least that's the general attitude. Again, I don't care whether this Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, you know, gets an award from the Dodgers or not. That doesn't matter. But when did it be okay? When did it become okay to, again, mock persons of faith? And believe me, I'm not arguing that organized religion is not worth its criticisms and things like that. But I was sitting there, you know, watching all these young people go through the confirmation process, and I thought, you know, it is true that there is kind of a war against organized religion, and it is one of the things that, you know, you can make fun of with no consequences at all. How did that happen, and is that really good for this country? 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. (855) 616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. And it's just this whole thing with the Dodgers, and who cares about the Dodgers and their Pride Night and stuff, but they originally decide to recognize this organization called the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, who I will use the description they use. These are men and women who dress up like Catholic nuns and priests, some in drag, some otherwise, heavy makeup and stuff, and they use let us just say it like this. They use religious imagery for satire. Now let your imagination run wild. And this is the group that the Dodgers, as part of Pride Night, have decided, and they do all sorts of stuff, and they do good stuff for the LGBT community, but this is their shtick, and it's to make fun of organized religion in general and Catholics in particular. And they, you know, they do outreach and they raise money to fight AIDS and things like that, all very worthwhile causes. But this is the group that the Dodgers decide that they're going to give a community service award. Then there's the backlash. So people complain. So then they pull that back. Then you get the other side that complains as well. And I guess my only point of this is, first of all, you would think that there would be a little bit of a vetting that goes on. But isn't it interesting that people of faith, okay, people of faith, those are the only people that it's okay to make fun of. And I'm still struggling with that. Tony in Muguanago. Tony, you're on WTMJ.
Yes, good afternoon, Jeff. How are you?
I am well, thank you. What do you think of all this?
I guess a pretty common question I would ask, and one probably a lot of people share, is, what would the perception be if this group was mocking the Muslim faith?
Right.
Be the same?
That's, Tony, what an interesting question, because I thought the same thing. What if this group, in this case, they're formed because they want to fight, you know, prejudice against, you know, the gay community and things like that. And of course, you know, in the Muslim faith, you know, they're depending on where you are and what your interpretations are, you can argue that there's a lack of tolerance towards, you know, that community as well. You raise an interesting point. What if this, instead of being a group that dresses up like Catholic priests and Catholic nuns, what if it was a group that dressed up as mullahs or whatever, same sort of scenario, and used it to, you know, mock positions on the gay community that organization might have, or women, or things like that. Go ahead.
And I think the Dodgers' response to that would be quite different.
Absolutely. And, no, it is. No, thanks for the call. See, I think it's a very valid point. And that's the larger point here. It just shows that apparently we have gotten to this point in American society where there are some groups that it is okay to mock, and others that aren't. And I'm not arguing that, you know, I'm not arguing that, again, in the analogy we used, that would be appropriate. But, you know, there's no way, in the analogy Tony used, you know that there's no way that the Dodgers would select that group, if that's what they were based on, to get a community award. And there would be outrage, and there would be protests. But when you pick a group that uses, again, religious imagery for satire, and men and women who dress up in drag like nuns and priests, and you know, and I do all sorts of good work, but you understand this is what there is a reason why they have chosen to dress up in the fashion that they do, and part of it is to be, again, mocking of the church, and they get away with it. 855-616-1620. Let's talk to Stephanie in Appleton. Stephanie, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. What do you think?
Okay, so I just had two thoughts, and I didn't hear your last caller, but I think it might be on the same lines. I mean, if they picked, like, a group of drag people dressed up in hijabs, how far would they get with that? That's number one. Number two is, I can't believe that they would choose to do something like this when they have so many Hispanic players on the team. Most of them are Catholics. And that would be almost like a slap in the face to them.
Yeah.
And that the players didn't stand up and say, hey, you know, this isn't right. You know, sort of like what the hockey players did.
Yeah, I guess going back to the larger point as well, I mean, and I have no issue with Pride Night. I have no issue with giving community awards. You would have thought from the Dodgers' perspective that somebody somewhere might have said, if we're going to give an award, there's all these great organizations that are doing outreach into this community and raising money. Maybe we could find one that's a tad less controversial than the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, where people dress up in drag, you know, as nuns and priests. You would have thought that there's, in all of the greater Los Angeles area, there's another group that you could give an award to that wouldn't have created all this controversy.
True, and like I said, and I'm sort of disappointed in the players, too, because, you know, they do have some, you know, all right, the Dodgers pay their salary, but if the, you know, if the majority of them would have said, hey, you know, this isn't right, we're not going to play that night, or, you know, I'm not going to participate, maybe they wouldn't have re-change their mind again. So
yeah. But you and our first caller both make the obvious point that's out there, and I guess it ties back to what I was saying, that there are some groups in America that you can make fun of. And if you want to make fun of the Catholic faith and people who believe in that, that's fair game. Go ahead, do whatever you want to do, but don't dare try to make fun of other groups. And I think the analogy that you're giving is perfectly correct. If you try to, have a similar sort of group that was built around mocking tenets of the Muslim faith that might not be as, user-friendly to LGBTQ issues, that there would be a huge outrage, and there's no way that it would be viewed in the same sort of fashion. I just bring this up because it is the double standard of intolerance which is out there. And again, this has nothing to do with the appropriateness of a pride night or things like that. It's just, it's frustrating to me, I guess. And one of the things, when I was at this event on Sunday, and one of the things that the bishop said in his remarks to the kids, he said, look, I'm really glad to see so many people who are coming forward and professing their faith, because the truth is it's not as easy to be a person of faith nowadays. And you have to understand that there are people that aren't going to like you because of that. And there's people that they feel that they're going to be able to mock you because of that. And in some cases, it is in many respects a kind of a lonely choice that's out there. And I think this is one of those things that demonstrate that. I guess I just don't know when it ever became, just popular or okay or tolerated to say, okay, there's certain groups here, and including people of faith, we're going to mock you. And, how dare you be offended if we mock you? And again, this has nothing to do with Pride Night. It has nothing to do with awarding community groups who are working to advance that community and make people better and raise money to fight AIDS. It's just a peculiar choice in this regard and a peculiar attitude. And still can't get over the fact that the Dodgers decided to get involved in the middle of this.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the program. Joy Behar. Know who Joy Behar is? She is the old, white, very liberal woman who appears on the View. And she apparently this morning, she was commenting on Tim Scott. If you were listening to the program yesterday, you know that I am a huge fan of South Carolina Senator Tim Scott. He was on I almost never do interviews. And during the election season last year, we had him in for an interview right before he was in Milwaukee, helping raise money for Ron Johnson and Republican candidates. And I had an opportunity to meet him in person, and I'm very, very impressed with him. He's a very, very compelling backstory for people who haven't been paying attention. His parents separated when he was very, very young. He was born into poverty. He was raised essentially by what turned out to be a single mom. Very, very self-made guy. He ended up, after he got out of college, he went to work selling insurance and turned that into an incredibly successful insurance agency, got involved in local politics, then was tabbed to replace South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint by then South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, went on to be elected to a full term with 60-some percent of the vote. He won re-election to the Senate with 62% of the vote last November. A really compelling backstory. And his message, if you listen to him, he's a guy who refuses to buy into the whole idea of racial politics. He says, look, there's real racism in this country, but this idea that it can't be overcome or that people are victims, he just rejects that. It's a very compelling message. It's also a very positive message. And we were talking about people of faith. He is unavowedly a person of faith. And so this is something that I guess, the idea that you have a black conservative who's now announced that he's running for president. And look, I don't know if he can beat Donald Trump. I don't know if he can, beat Ron DeSantis. DeSantis is going to officially announce that he's running for president tomorrow. But all I'm saying is that Tim Scott, in my opinion, is an extremely impressive candidate who, because the media and especially the left feels it needs to destroy particularly black conservatives, you're going to get all sorts of attention. So anyhow, Joy Behar, she apparently today went on TV and said that Tim Scott has no clue what it's like to be a black man in America. Okay, so you have this older white woman who's out there telling Tim Scott that he has no idea what it's like to be a black man in America. She says he, and also and Clarence Thomas as well, believe in pulling yourself up by your bootstraps rather than understanding that racism, the racism that African Americans face in this country. Well, you know, that's this really interesting attitude that, again, that you have people like Joy Behar that have the audacity to tell somebody who has accomplished things. And all I'm saying is that I think Tim Scott's a guy that I hope people get a chance to listen to his message, because he strikes me as the type of person, whether he wins the presidential nomination or not, he strikes me as the type of person that we should have in politics. And I roll my eyes when, you know, you have, okay, well, he can't understand what it's like to be a black man in this country. Okay. All right. There you go. When he, you know, and it is funny because this is what, again, you have particularly the mainstream media that's out there. After he gave the response to Joe Biden's first State of the Union, it just exploded in the Twitterverse where, I mean, he was described by a lot of people on the left as Uncle Tim, like Uncle Tom. How dare that a person of color come out and challenge what the orthodoxy is? He just must not understand the black experience at all. Well, tell that to, again, a guy who, you know, was raised in poverty and, you know, did managed to do the right things and has been incredibly successful and is trying to bring that message to people. And if this is just the start, I mean, it's what's going to happen more and more, particularly if his candidacy decides to gain traction. There was a story I want to comment on because it's kind of a follow-up to something we talked about the other day, and I'm not going to make a conscious decision not to take phone calls, but it's one of the things that candidly, I mean, I've been doing this radio show for 25 years, and it's a situation that's in the back of my mind. It is the nightmare for any person who does live broadcasts, whether you're on radio or whether you're on TV, because what I do is not scripted. I mean, I'm sitting here. It's an open microphone. We live stream. So you got the cameras on, and, you know, what you say, you know, goes out over the air, and there's a delay, and I guess you can snatch it back. But, you know, sometimes what happens is you misspeak, and you don't even know that you have done that. And then some people on the text line will say, "Do you know what it was that you exactly said?" So there's always that danger that's out there that you're just going to simply misspeak. And then, of course, there's misspeaking, and there is misspeaking. May 5th. A longtime play-by-play announcer for the Oakland Athletics. His name is Glenn Kuiper. He's been there for years and years. What happened on May 5th is they're live, and they're doing this pregame show, and he is discussing his visit to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. And he's talking about how they went there. And he goes to introduce this, and he uses a different N-word. And he doesn't, and apparently he didn't even know he had said it. It was just kind of, he misspoke, didn't even know he had said it at the time, and his partner didn't say anything at the moment. And so what happens, everybody agrees that this was a slip of the tongue. Nobody argues that it was an intentional use of a racial slur. It was a slip of the tongue. He meant to use the proper name of this museum, and he misspoke. Oh, my gosh. But, I mean, I acknowledge there's misspeaking and there's misspeaking, but it wasn't an intentional sort of thing. So what happens is NBC Sports California suspends him. It suspends him for this slip of the tongue. The decision now is apparently, and this is the follow-up, following an internal review, the decision has been made for NBC Sports California to end its relationship with Glenn Kuiper effective immediately. We thank him for his dedication to Bay Area baseball over the years. So this, what everybody agrees, is a slip of the tongue. It's now cost this guy his career of 20 years. He's been fired over the slip of the tongue. And I don't know what the larger point of this is. Maybe a suspension would be appropriate. I guess I just look at these things, and maybe I look at it from my personal perspective, which is as somebody who does spoken word radio and is on the air 3 hours a day, you know, 5 days a week, and there's always that chance that you're going to mispronounce a word or misspeak or whatever. And I understand that, you know, there's some areas that you got to be much more careful of when you enunciate and things like that. But I look at this guy. Nobody argues that there was an intent to issue a racial slur. Nobody argues that. And, you know, do I really care? I mean, do I care about who the play-by-play announcer is for the Oakland Athletics? No. But I do, in a world where we are constantly told that we need to have more forgiveness and we need to have more understanding and we need to have more tolerance, a situation where you have somebody that, again, it's just he misspoke. He misspoke. It was a slip of the tongue or whatever. It was a bad slip of the tongue. But where there is no evil intent at all, there's no history of this sort of behavior. It was just a mispronounced word, a bad mispronounced word, but a mispronounced word, period. It's interesting to me that this costs the guy the job, that we can't just simply, and he issued an apology for it. He said, I'm embarrassed. I did not mean this in any sort of way. It's just, it's interesting to me that there's so much stuff that we're told that we have to be tolerant of and we have to be forgiving of, but yet there's some things that we have this kind of zero tolerance approach for. And I bring this story up only because anybody who has aspires to have a career, you know, doing live broadcasting or whatever, you know, this is a cautionary tale, because even if it is an innocent mistake, it can cost you your career. And this is exhibit number one. A couple of our texters are making points like, well, it was in his, that word is in his vocabulary. So that it might have been more than the slip of the tongue. Well, I'm sorry, that word is in everybody's vocabulary. If you've read Mark Twain, if you've read To Kill a Mockingbird, if you listen to rap music, if you've listened to Richard Pryor, you know, comedy concerts. I mean, we're all familiar with that word. So, but that doesn't mean you use that word. And one of our texters said, Jeff, you've been on the air for going on 30 years. And if you were using that word, it wouldn't be viewed well. Well, I understand. And I have never had that slip of the tongue. That is not a word that I use, period. But I don't think it was a word that this guy used either. It was just he misspoke. And it's cost him his job, and maybe it's cost him his career. And I guess I just wonder the fairness of that. If there was evil intent, that's a whole different story. But absent, I don't know, absent intent, I just think that, you know, if you have an example of like real racism, well, you punish the real racism. Nobody's going to defend that. But a guy who misspeaks, you know, after 20 years on the air, that costs him his job. And that's where I wonder about the fairness and whether or not the punishment fits the crime, which I guess is the larger point of this. All right, I've been waiting all day to discuss this with you. There are two types of people in the world. There are people who return stuff, and there are people who don't. I admit that I am almost always in the category of I don't return stuff. If I buy something on Amazon and it comes and it's not quite right, well, I admit I'm bad about going through the trouble of returning the stuff. And normally it's, unless it's like a really big ticket item. But if I order, I don't know, a belt or something and it doesn't fit or it's not exactly right, the chances of me sending it back are not great. My beautiful wife, though, is exactly the opposite. And she, if something isn't exactly right, you know, she will she will take stuff back, and she makes a point of it. And I appreciate that from a fiscal standpoint because, you know, she'll say, well, you know, there'll be a charge on the credit card, but make sure, you know, make sure we get the credit back because I took back that pair of shoes or I took back that blouse or whatever. So I applaud the fact that she ends up doing that. And again, but there's two types of people in the world. There are the returners and there aren't. But here's the story. Apparently, retailers have been clamping down on returns because returns are one of the biggest profit drains for particularly online retailers. And it used to be that, okay, you know, you ordered something online and there were like a large window of time to return it, that there were little or no fees, et cetera, et cetera. That is all changing. Return rates surged during the COVID-19 pandemic as more people went to online shopping. And what people would do is they would frequently buy multiple sizes of the same item because they were unsure of the fit. Okay, you know, do I buy the extra large or the large shirt because I don't exactly know how I'm going to fit it? I know what I'll do. I'll buy both. I'll buy the large, I'll buy the extra large, and then I'll send back the one that doesn't fit right. Return rates in 2022 were 14% higher than in 2019. On average, the cost to process $100 of return merchandise is about $26.50. Wow, that's a lot. So what they're doing is a lot of retailers are starting to, again, charge money for returns, particularly returns by mail. Now, the problem is that many customers say that free returns is the most important thing for them. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. I am always fascinated by, you know, these various trends. Now, it's, you know, if you go into a brick and mortar store, chances are, you know, you're going to try stuff on. So you're going to have an idea as to whether or not that particular brand of jeans ends up fitting you or not. And in my case, I mean, I order jeans through the mail, but it's I know the brand, I know the size, and thankfully I still fit into the size that I have. So it's no problem. I know if I order Levi's in this particular size, they are going to fit. But a lot of times people don't do that when they order online. How important is the ability to return something essentially for free? How important is that? And as retailers start to make it more expensive to return stuff, is that going to change how you shop, particularly online? 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. Jeff, I have girlfriends who buy three different sizes of things to bring home for kids to try on, and then they take the rest back. Trying to bring younger kids into a store to try clothes on is never a fun event, I can imagine. If they were charged a restocking fee, I'm sure this would change their behavior a little bit. Yeah, I guess the question, though, is if you were in that instance to charge a restocking fee, Would your friends continue to shop at that particular store, or would they simply say, okay, I'm not going to, if Von Maur is going to charge me a restocking fee, then I'm going to go to Target or I'm going to go to somewhere else. And I guess that's the balancing act that's there. When you take stuff back, it costs the retailers a lot of money. I mean, this, and again, we're talking right now, this is the online thing. But customers still say, you know, free returns is something that is very, very important to us. Jeff, the plastic shippers that small Amazon stuff come in are reversible. When you turn them inside out, they have a return label printed on the inside of the baggie, and it has an adhesive strip to seal it to the polyester bag. It is not hard. I mean, I acknowledge that they make it easy to return stuff. I mean, you have to, you know, fill that out. You have to put the stuff on the outside, but then you drop it in the UPS drop box or the FedEx box or wherever they take it. I mean, I agree that they make it easy to do it. The question is, are they making it too easy to do that moving forward? Okay, so Wyatt, one of the things, now that we live stream as well, so there's a number of people who watch us, of course, you know, in addition to listening to us, and one of the things is we get comments on clothing all the time. So, like, a couple of people were commenting on my Tommy Bahama royal blue, you know, shirt, which is actually one of my favorites.
Yeah, sorry to upstage you, Jeff.
Well, you got, what are the, those are cactus?
These are cactuses. This okay. This was a Milwaukee Goodwill find, and I saw it. And it spoke to me.
Okay. Well, see, that is in and of a nutshell is the difference between the two of us. You know, you're wearing the cactus shirt from Goodwill, and I'm wearing the Tommy Bahama royal blue shirt, you know?
Yeah, that really is the difference between us.
There you go. But I like that as well. So that is, we always encourage people. I saw McCure earlier today. He was wearing a tie. I don't think I've seen John McCure wear a tie, you know, in ages, but he was wearing a tie. So, you know, we are stepping up. At least some of us are stepping up our game, you know, with
all the streaming.
As long as
I'm on your show and it continues to be nice weather, the viewers will get to see more of my fun button-down shirts.
There you go. Well, that is exactly right. So, you know, we're going to be rolling out the spring and summer collections from the Barmore Pooley camp and the Wagner camp as well. Okay, so something for everybody to look forward to. Speaking of that, when we come back, what is the mayor so afraid of? Stick around. Hey, here's some breaking news. If you are one of the millions of people that have an account, a Netflix streaming account, starting today, Netflix is bringing its password sharing deterrence to the U.S. Beginning today, Netflix is starting to roll out its paid sharing feature in the U.S. Now, if people have been following this controversy, you know, if you sign up for a streaming service, whether it's Netflix or Hulu or HBO Max or whatever, you pay for it. The problem that Netflix has been having is that you have a primary account holder. Okay, let's say it's Charlie. And what Charlie does, he pays the however much a month it is for Netflix, but then he gives his login information to me and a handful of other people, and we all log in on Charlie's account. So instead of us each paying our monthly Netflix fee, Charlie pays the Netflix fee, and the rest of us kind of get a free ride on that. But the effect is Netflix, instead of selling 7 subscriptions, only gets to sell 1, and they are trying to crack down on it. So what they are going to be doing is requiring all account users to be in the same household and live in the same location as the primary account holder. Users living outside of a household will be able to join on to the main account, but it's going to cost you an extra $8 a month. I'm still trying to figure out exactly how this works, and as often happens, what it means to me. It says, the story I'm looking at, which is in the Hollywood Reporter, as part of the rollout, primary account holders will be prompted to set a household location on their devices. Those subscribers will still be able to use their accounts when traveling. Non-household members will be singled out based on factors like how often the device has used the Wi-Fi at the primary location and will be prompted to transfer their profiles to a new Netflix subscription. I understand what they are trying to get at. I wonder, I always try to personalize this. So I have my primary residence, which is here. We also have a condo in Florida. So when we are at the condo in Florida, that has Netflix. And so when I'm at the condo in Florida, I use Netflix through my account. And when I'm here, I use Netflix from my account. We're not using it at multiple occasions. But I'm going to be curious to see exactly how that plays out, because there's no way I'm paying 2 monthly fees to use it both in Milwaukee and to use it in Florida. So I don't exactly know how that one's going to work out. But if you've been one of the people who've been free riding, I guess is the phrase they use, Netflix is going to be trying to crack down on it. How exactly it's going to work and how successful it's going to be, I guess, remains to be seen. But Netflix is starting to roll that out beginning today. Okay, Jeff, what about my college-age kids in Minnesota? Well, I think that they're going to have to be added on to accounts if they're listening to it regularly, if they're watching Netflix regularly in Minnesota. But it will all work out. Like I say, if Netflix expects me to pay for me when I'm in Florida separately from me here, good luck with that. That might be the time that I decide, well, maybe I can get by with all the other streaming services that we end up having. or picking and choosing between them. All right. During Wyatt's news, he was talking about Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson, who's testifying in front of the Senate committee today, arguing that the shared revenue plan, first of all, okay, Milwaukee's going to be facing bankruptcy in a couple of years. Well, okay, Milwaukee can't go bankrupt. I mean, the municipalities in the state of Wisconsin cannot go bankrupt unless the state legislature passes laws which allow them to do that. So when you have the phrase bankruptcy thrown around, that's not possible unless the legislature lets them go bankrupt, which I think is probably extremely unlikely. But regardless, there's no question that Milwaukee is looking at a financial cliff. Part of it is because shared revenue has been frozen. Part of it is because they have spent like a drunken sailor for years and years. Sorry, no offense to drunken sailors. And part of it is because the pension obligations are just out of control. Years and years ago, Milwaukee gave, in an effort to make unionized employees happy, Milwaukee gave all sorts of things away to the government workers. And it was easy to do that 30 years ago because, hey, you know, 30 years ago, the people aren't retiring. So let's give them that. It's not going to cost us anything until people start retiring. Well, now people are starting to retire and the pension obligations are going through the roof. So it's a complicated dynamic, but yes, there are huge fiscal problems that are there. For years, city and county leaders have been arguing, and this is what I acknowledge drives me crazy about this argument. They have been saying, let us have a referendum on the sales tax. If we can go to Milwaukee voters, county and or city, and we can make this case, we need more money. Let us have a referendum. Let us have a referendum. Please let us have a referendum. Okay, so the assembly in Wisconsin, they cut this shared revenue deal, and they say one of the conditions of raising the sales tax by 2% on the city and an extra like 0.3% on the county, all right, you for years you've been arguing you want a referendum. Well, okay, we're going to do that. If you have a referendum and the voters are willing to do this, fine, we're going to let you do it. This is what the leaders have been asking for years and years. And what, quite frankly, I have been arguing they should. To me, it's a matter of local control. If people in the city of Milwaukee or people in Milwaukee County want to vote to raise their sales tax, I think we should have let them do it. I do. I think that that's just like when we have school referendums. We allow people to decide on whether they're going to spend spending cap, low spending caps or not. So the legislature, the assembly, gives leaders in Milwaukee what they have been begging for years. Okay, we're going to let you increase the sales tax. The condition is that you have to go to a referendum. And now everybody is freaked out about it. The mayor is apparently in Madison saying, "Oh, we don't want that. We don't want a referendum here. We just want to be able to do it. We want to have the leaders. We want to have the members of the Common Council just be able to vote on this. All that stuff we said over the years about let us have a referendum. Let us have a referendum. Never mind." Because they, I guess, apparently are afraid that the voters will end up saying no. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the old National Bank talk and text line. Now, I understand a part of this is, you know, be careful what you wish for, but you might get it. But I guess my point here is, if you're talking about what will be a massive sales tax increase, you know, 2% in the city of Milwaukee tacked on with an extra 0.3% on top of what is already there. I mean, isn't this something that the voters should be able to decide? And if it's not something that we should leave up to the voters, what have elected officials been talking about over the course of the last several years? And if the voters end up saying no, all right, doesn't that tell you something? I mean, this idea, I guess, that the elected officials happen to must think that the voters are too stupid to go along with them when they say that there's this dire need. To me, you have the referendum, and if the voters end up saying no, well, that's their message, and then maybe you do have to make all the service cuts and things like this. But why shouldn't the voters be able to have some sort of input on what is a massive tax increase? And if this is what they've been asking for years, why are we now so afraid of it? 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. We discuss. I find this interesting that over the last several years, as an argument for local control, local leaders have been saying, we want a referendum on increasing our sales tax. We've got this fiscal cliff that's here because of pension obligations and things of the like and freezes on shared revenue. So let us vote. Let us go to a referendum. Matter of fact, there was a non-binding referendum about increasing the sales tax a while back, and it passed. So, I've always been impressed by that argument. To me, it's been local control. If Milwaukee wants to raise its sales tax and the voters decide, why not? So that's exactly what the assembly has done. All right, we're going to let you do it. And rather than make the case to the voters as to why there is the need, you now have people that are absolutely panicked, these elected officials saying, well, wait a second. What if they say no? Well, what if they say no? Well, okay. Then they say no. But after years and years of arguing for a referendum, it's interesting to me that people now have cold feet. John in Hales Corners. John, you're on WTMJ.
Yeah, good afternoon, Jeff.
Hi, John.
Hi. I just wanted to correct a little bit of what you're talking about the pension system draining the city's coffers.
Yeah.
The city of Milwaukee pension is separate from the city or the county
yes.
of Milwaukee.
Yes.
There's two different pension systems.
Yeah.
The cities are, you know, that the firefighters, police, that is very, very solvent. We're over $4 billion in it. So that's, we're not draining, people say, oh, you're draining, you're a tax robber, because no, that's county workers.
Well, also,
city workers, we have our own pension system.
Well, but the pension obligations, and it's not just the fire and police, but it's also all the other city employees as well. I mean, they're taught, right, the county is in a huge amount of trouble. There's no question about that. Am I wrong?
Correct.
The program is to take the city workers and put them on the state pension as well, right? I'm right about that, aren't I?
Oh, they've been trying to do that for years because we're so solvent, they would love to have our money.
Yeah.
Tom Barrett added two positions to our pension board just so he was trying to get control because we have representatives from the police department, fire department, and then from the city. He added two more positions to it because he wanted to try to get his hands on some of that pension money.
Yeah, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. No, I understand, and there's a solvency, right? I get that the city and the county are different, but the city is talking about its pension obligations as well moving forward, and that's why the plan is, I think, to put all the pensions on the state system. Jeff, as a homeowner, resident of the city of Milwaukee, yes to voting referendum on increasing the sales tax and an absolute no to allowing a common council vote. Another more urgent reason to try and move it is the very people who benefit from the generous pension are in sole control of the decision. I just think this is, again, I think it will pass. I mean, I just really believe that if you have a referendum, and I mean, I appreciate the argument that people are making and looking at the fiscal reality, and nobody wants to see them have to get rid of hundreds of cops and firefighters and things of the like. I mean, I guess I look at around Wisconsin, you look at school referendums, and a lot of the school referendums are candidly a lot less compelling than what I think that the city of Milwaukee or Milwaukee County could make with regard to some of their financial decisions. These school referendums pass. What, 80-85% of the school referendums pass? Again, it's just fascinating to me that now people have become afraid of that they don't think that they can make that case for a sales tax increase after talking about for years and years, just give us a chance to do this. Jeff, I'd like to know why the leader of the Senate is at 180 degrees odds with the assembly leader about the referendum. Well, I think what's going on is you have members of the business community from Milwaukee who are going to the Senate and saying, hey, we know we've been asking for this referendum for the longest time, but the truth is we don't think it's going to pass, or we're afraid that people might say no. And if they say no, what are we going to do then? And that's, I think, caught the attention of at least the Senate leader. I'm not sure how rank and file senators feel about that. I guess my reaction would be, why don't we trust the voters? And, you know, if I were the business community and I were these elected officials, I'd worry less about what could be a deal breaker and more about, okay, how are we going to sell this to the voters? Because candidly, the political reality of this is if you insist that there be no vote, I don't think this is going to, if you insist that there be no referendum, I don't think you're going to get it through the assembly. That's just the bottom line. So nothing's going to end up happening. And then you are going to walk off that fiscal cliff, put it to a vote. My guess is it's going to pass, and then we move on.